Let me read a couple of quotes from my next guest. The capacity to produce social chaos is the last resort of desperate people. Another, you can't lead the people if you don't love the people, and you can't save the people if you don't serve the people. There's music in those words, as well as pain, wisdom, and honesty. Those are the words of Cornel West. Every time I see that Dr. West is going to be in L.A., I try to get him in the studio with me. I'll tell you why. He's not only fiercely intelligent, boldly articulate, and politically passionate, but in our first interview, I found him to be one of the best listeners and most humble conversationalists I've ever interviewed. For someone who speaks in highly quotable near paragraphs at times, Cornel West probably said, you know, I hadn't thought of it that way, or I'm going to have to think about that more than any other person I've interviewed in over a decade of doing this show. And that means a lot to me. Very often people say, how did an interview go? I say, they couldn't make it a conversation. You know, they had to do their stump speech. They're on their tour, and they did the same old, but not Dr. West. Cornel West has just come out with his memoir, Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud. In it, he writes, until now, I've never taken the time to focus on the inner dynamics of my soul. Educator and philosopher Dr. Cornel West is the class of 1943, University Professor of Religion and African American Studies at Princeton University. He's won numerous awards, including the American Book Award, and has received more than 20 honorary degrees. He's produced 3 CDs of music and spoken word, offers commentary on the Tavis Smiley Show, and is the author of several books, including Race Matters, Democracy Matters, Hope on a Tightrope, and as I said, his latest, Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud. Welcome again, Cornel West.
Always a blessing to be on Free Form, and my dear brother Terry, we've had some wonderful times together, and those are some very kind and generous words that you say, I tell you.
But I wouldn't say them if they weren't true. I've said it over the years,
actually. I appreciate that.
So I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. Well, in this case, that's what the whole book is about.
Yeah, that's true.
How did this book happen?
Brother Tav was smiling. He said, Doc, he said, Brother Wes, he said, I would love to see you put on paper who you are. He said, who are you really? I said, well, as Augustine says, I'm a mystery to myself. I haven't examined the dark precincts of my own personality. And so I had a chance to do this, and along with my dear brother David Ritz, of course, who's such a towering artist when it comes to story, narrative, capturing voice, that I want to make sure that this was a conversational voice. It was a talking book in that sense. And because I aspire to be a blues man in the life of the mind and a jazz man in the world of ideas, I wanted somebody who had a sensibility to capture the voice of a blues man. And, of course, beginning with Mom and Dad, Irene and Cliff, Sacramento, Shiloh Baptist Church, the neighborhood, sports, girlfriends and things, I wanted to really lay bare what the making of this particular instance of a tradition, because I really am a person and I have my own individuality and I try to forge my own voice and style, but I'm very much a part of a tradition. I'm not a self-made man. You know that American myth that goes back to Ben Franklin and even elements of it in Frederick Douglass, that I'm the opposite of that. I am in no way self-made. I come out of a tradition, community, a struggle of a heritage that exemplifies struggle for justice and freedom. And I'm very blessed to be a part of the family and that tradition and community.
You know, you said Tavis Smiley, because I do know from reading some of this, and you said that he's the one who said, we need it, do
yeah,
it.
Absolutely.
What role did your cancer diagnosis play in it?
Well, that's a good question, though, brother. I think that in some way, you know, my struggling with cancer was a intensifying of my dance with mortality. And death has a way of arresting the mind, as Samuel Johnson used to put it. And so I there's no doubt, you're absolutely right, that the near-death experience of cancer did make me think about the life that I have lived. And I should say that telling one's life story is itself a life-transforming experience.
How so?
That you begin to really slow down. I'm on the move all the time, you know, over 200 events every year for 25, 30 years, and you have to just stop, engage in serious retrospection. in terms of not just events passing, but the deeper meaning and significance as it affected your heart, mind, and soul, and loved ones.
Let me ask you, you've written many books. You write a lot. You're telling me there's something qualitatively different. You could, I'm guessing, you could write some of those other books on the plane, between things. This one was different.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say on the plane. I'm still in the library. But, I mean, if I'm writing, you know, History of American Pragmatism from Emerson to Richard Rorty with Quine and Peirce and James and Dewey and others, I could write that in the library, engaging with the text. Whereas this book is just me and the realities and the page.
Yeah.
That's it.
And all the choices then become... How deep do I go? What do I mention?
That's right. What? How far do I pursue certain kinds of issues? When it gets painful, it really hurts. When it's joyful, you want to stay there for a long time, but you've got to shift. So you're absolutely right. It's a very different kind of process. And I'd always vowed that I would hold off on doing something like this because, I don't know, maybe just my Christian formation, you know, that a preoccupation with self for too long leads toward a kind of narcissism and a egocentrism that I abhor. And so I had to somehow walk this balance between telling a story about myself that revealed the degree to which I am tied, intertwined, entangled with mom, dad, sisters, brothers, friends, comrades, and so on. But on the other hand, I did have to focus just on me, too. Oh, yes.
And for people who just heard us mention cancer but don't know how it turned out, your original word was much more threatening than luckily it turned out, correct?
Absolutely. Well, when I found out about the prostate cancer, they said you had the most aggressive form. It's the last stage. You might have a few months to live. And I said, ooh, wow, I better slow down. And I said to myself, I said, well, you know, I've been invited to the banquet of life for 48 years. I had an abundance of blessings, so I can't get greedy about this. If it's time to go, it's time to go. I accept my fate. If that's God's will, that's cool. I've already lived such unbelievable life that death cannot in any way rob me of the joys I've already experienced and the love I've already had. On the other hand, I said, I've got to gear up and fight. Because I do love life now. I love to live, even though I'm blessed to live. And thank God, Brother Peter Scardino, one of the finest of doctors in the country dealing with prostate cancer, went in radical surgery. 6 hours later, I'm bouncing back, and here I am, still going and borrowed time, even though we all got a death sentence in time and space. Sooner or later, you got to go.
Right, right.
But not at the moment.
Right. Born astride the grave, right?
Yes. That's Samuel Beckett. That's my dear Beckett.
To jump from yourself, well, wait, no, let's stay with yourself a little bit more. You say that this book really began in a church in Sacramento. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, I think I wanted to start, actually, after giving people a sense of my travels and so on, because I'm on the move all the time. I don't think I've spent one weekend in Princeton ever in my life.
And let me just cut in for people who haven't seen the documentary An Examined Life, which you're one of the philosophers that they interview in that. Yours actually, I think, is in a moving car.
That's true.
That's
true. I was on my way to a lecture. I was on the way here, absolutely. Well, we had a lot of fun with Sister Taylor in that movie. But it does start in Shiloh. My brother is being ordained as a deacon. That's my mother's tears are flowing. And it hits me that in the end, I am still a Shiloh Baptist kind of brother. I may be a philosopher with a groove. I may be a person who has an attitude of gratitude in terms of being thankful for what I have and a freedom fighter and someone who has tremendous joy and delight in music of various kinds. But fundamentally, I'm a Shiloh Baptist kind of brother. That's what has shaped me, the music, the styles, the love, the preoccupation of a first century Palestinian Jew named Jesus who was put to death by a vicious Roman Empire. Innocent blood flowing on the one hand, but compassion still responding to that imperial blow and assault against Jesus. That's what shaped me. And that's kind of the substratum.
Yeah, yeah.
Of who I am.
You and I, as we said off air before we started, share a little bit. I got to Harvard in 1965, and though I am white, I know I was an affirmative action kind of a kid. We were poor. I was Catholic. I was from the South. And I remember being so intimidated by the folks who'd come from the prep schools and what I had walked into. How about yourself?
Intimidated might be too strong a word. I just knew that they came from another planet. There's no doubt about that. I mean, they were human, but there's an alienness about them. Their style and their sometimes a confidence that verged on arrogance. And here I'm from Sacramento, California. I'm very kind of comfortable in my skin. I knew it was going to be a challenge because my public high school was in no way commensurate with Exeter or Andover or
Same
Choate
here. Yeah.
And so forth. You know. But on the other hand, I always felt I had something to bring. You know what I mean? I mean, I guess part of it just had to do with, you know, I had Curtis Mayfield and the White Brothers had the Beach Boys, and I just thought Curtis was deeper than Brian Wilson and company, as much as I appreciate Wilson and the boys. So I always knew I had something to bring, even as I had to be open to learn and listen, and that's what Harvard was, as it was for you. Marx and Weber and Durkheim and Kant and Hegel and Nietzsche and Schopenhauer and Plato and Aristotle and Descartes and Hume. I'm just like, oh, my God, it's a whole new world.
Yeah, and the other students,
the students, it was like
whoa, the challenge, the creative tension, just of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But you know, one of the things that I noticed at Harvard was I always felt as if, at least at that time, that many of we young black folk, we had a certain spiritual depth and a certain kind of moral sensitivity that gave us that was a source of strength. So even the folk who had been exposed intellectually, you got the feeling they were socially underdeveloped. And they were spiritually, if not impoverished, on the verge of it. And so there was an interesting kind of give and take that took place. You know, and of course I just use the music as one indicator, but there's other
ways
as well.
No.
How you relate to people, how you negotiate in context, how they respond to new circumstances.
That's right.
So
the truth is that folks like us were new to them.
Exactly. And see, they had been in that same bubble from seventh grade.
That's
you know,
right.
You go from Exeter all the way to Harvard, that's the same bubble.
Yeah.
You and I, we're in a different situation.
Yeah.
From the South, white brother, Catholic, you're going into WASDom. I'm black, Sacramento, I'm going into WASDom, but it WASD elite.
Yeah.
And, you know, we knew that we had much to learn from them, but they had something to learn from us, too.
Absolutely.
Now.
You know, I had Skip Gates in here a few years ago. We talked about his experience as well. As I'm sitting here talking to you, I'm reminded of his recent experience. And in reading an interview, you said that you actually were questioned about a crime while at Harvard?
Oh, I almost went to jail. They had charges of rape against me and two of my roommates. A white sister who had been raped. And we were put on a line, and the police actually put pressure on the sister, saying, you know one of these three did it. She said, no, a Negro did it, but not these Negroes. And I salute that white sister. She was courageous in her bearing witness to truth and justice, because I'd been in a cell right now, probably.
Yeah.
So in that regard, the issue of arbitrary police power has always been a crucial issue in poor communities and in poor black communities, poor brown and so forth. And, you know, you can't just end it with a beer summit and think it's over. This is very real. You want to find out the facts. Make sure everybody's treated fairly. But arbitrary police power is no plaything at all.
Well, I mean, if we go back to, I saw when Barack Obama responded to the question in the press conference. And at that point, he was...
That was a gut response.
It was a gut response.
That was a gut response. And then he became the politician that he's such a master at these days.
Yeah, let's talk...
Calculating and strategizing.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about Barack Obama. Let
God
me say, I saw... Michael Moore's movie last night.
I saw it,
you know,
too.
Powerful movie.
Powerful.
My fiance said the moment that was the saddest for her was watching how excited people were the night Barack Obama was elected.
Yeah.
Share a little bit, if you would, Cornel West, about your feelings that night and your feelings today.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was ready because I draw a radical distinction between the symbolic and the substantial. That as a critical supporter of Barack Obama and engaged in over 50 events from him from Iowa to Ohio, I knew that at a symbolic level something was could happen that was unprecedented. And it did happen. And at that symbolic level, I can understand the tears, I can understand the jubilation, I can understand the euphoria. But I always knew that there was a sense in which him now heading the American empire, tied to the shadow government, tied to CIA, FBI, tied to the establishment, waiting to embrace him. And it was clear when he chose his economic team, when he chose his foreign policy team, he was choosing, of course, some recycled neoliberals and recycled neoclintonites, that substantially you're going to end up with these technocratic policies that consider poor people and working people as afterthoughts, beginning with bankers, beginning with elites. Symbolically, black man breakthrough makes you want to break dance. So we had to be able to relate to both of these. So I resonate with your dear fiance because of the hopes that were generated and the call for change, and then we end up with this recycled neoliberalism. There's no fundamental change at all.
Yeah,
that's very real. But I think we do have to understand we had to bring the age of Reagan to a close.
Yes.
We had to bring the era of conservatism to a close. And then you try to unleash new possibilities. And the question now is, how do we keep our fellow citizens awakened so it goes beyond the campaign for a candidate and really begins to engage in grassroots organizing and mobilizing?
Yeah. One of the things that I've also felt myself is that I'm more disheartened these days than I was during the 8 years of Bush. During the 8 years of Bush, I expected nothing. You know, I was surprised by almost nothing. And you know, we fought. We did what we could. This one gets a little sadness in my soul as I watch it.
Yeah.
And I know that you've talked about that Obama's looking at the wrong Lincoln. That Lincoln or Roosevelt, who shows so well in Michael Moore's movie with the new Bill of Rights.
For freedom.
But that Roosevelt came to power as a moderate. Lincoln came to power as someone who had worked very comfortably with slavery.
Absolutely.
And it was the movements, it was the people.
That's right.
That challenged and inspired them. How are we doing and how are we going to do?
We are not doing well at all. If you look at the abolitionist movement and its impact on Abraham Lincoln, the Frederick Douglasses, the Harriet Beecher Stowes, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, Wendell Phillips, Charles Sumner, all of those tyrants, William Lloyd Garrison, we can go on, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman. The abolitionist movement that was powerful put pressure on Lincoln. Trade union movement put pressure on FDR. What kind of movement do we have? Hardly anything at all. That's where the analogy breaks down.
Yeah.
And that's in part where, you know, Barack Obama then leans toward the Wall Street, mesmerized by the elites, wants to be embraced by the establishment, wants to preserve his legacy as a president, more in the language of the neoliberal and neoconservative columnists than in the hearts and minds of everyday people.
Yeah. So we both agree the age of Reagan, and again, more lays it out very well for people who haven't seen that film yet. You know, this election does say that's over, but it doesn't say what's starting, does it?
That's true. I mean, even my dear brother Michael Moore tends to, I think, put too much confidence in Barack Obama. Even in the film, you get this sense that here comes Barack Obama speaking the language of a deep Democrat.
Yeah.
No. He's been a liberal all of his life. He's using that language to mobilize, but in the end, he's going to capitulate and defer to the neoliberal establishment, which is what he has done so far. Now, granted, I mean, there's still some possibilities there, you know, even when you talk about just extending unemployment benefits. This is nothing revolutionary at all, but it does alleviate some of the suffering. But if we don't get some restructuring going on, and if we don't get some Marshall Plan activity of massive investment
in this country,
in infrastructure here, you got $4 billion every month in Afghanistan, and you can come up with that all the time.
The meter just runs when we're at war.
The meter just runs. Unlimited.
We talked a little bit about Larry Summers last time. Just briefly, you had personal experiences with him, but he really means a lot to you symbolically in terms of Obama, yes?
He does, I think, because Larry Summers, and I would seriously say I forgive him in terms of disrespecting and dishonoring me. I just draw my own lines in the sand. But I won't demonize the brother. I pray for the brother. I want to live a life of joy. I don't think there's too much joy in disrespecting people. So I wouldn't choose that way of life myself. But the thing is that he has a braininess that lacks wisdom and vision. And he has a smartness that lacks a sensitivity to the poor and the marginal. So that kind of braininess and smartness, you and I encountered a lot of that at Harvard. I don't find that attractive or appealing at all. I think that it's empty in a certain sense. And I was just surprised that Barack Obama could be seduced by that kind of braininess and smartness that really has policies that don't put jobs at the center. It's an afterthought.
Yeah, and houses. And homes.
And homes. Yeah. Exactly. And homes. Absolutely.
Yeah. As I've said, and I've said on the show before, it's like, do they ever ask the question, so how do we save the banks? I don't hear them asking the question, how do we save the people?
The people. Absolutely. And you would think it would follow from some of the populist language that Brother Obama used during the campaign, but who is around the table when he, you know, shapes his policy? You don't have any people representing the labor movement other than our Secretary of Labor.
Well, on health reform, when he has doctors, there's the doctor who represents single payer has to crash the party.
That's exactly right.
I mean,
that's exactly right. I mean, it's that kind of reflection of just how broken the system is. You got a majority of fellow citizens who want universal health care, and he can't even view public option as indispensable and untouchable. You say, what's going on? Pharmaceutical companies, drug companies, powerful. $300 million spent for lobbyists. That's a broken system.
Yeah, it's a terrible, terrible. I have often said that unless we get public financing, that every other issue will always, you'll look in, you know, at the distant goal and you'll end up, you know, on
that's
the 10-yard line.
That's exactly right.
And I often say, you know, if we all just put aside every other issue for a year or two
and
say, one thing we're doing, public finance and public. Now, of course, as you know, Supreme Court rule that corporations can give unlimited funds, changing a 100-year precedent for this conservative court. That day, which may come soon, I don't know what happens then, because I'm not sure that the public will understand what that means.
What that really means. It means we're locked in an iron cage of a neoliberal mediocrity or neoconservative mediocrity, which means the needs of the people will never be fundamentally met if they're poor and working class. And that either leads toward a thickening of the cynicism or it leads toward new expressions of social chaos.
Right. Going back to that first quote I read. That's the articulation of desperate people.
That's exactly right.
Let me finally, we've got about 3 minutes. Let me ask you, you really do talk about music a lot. Mm-hmm. And see yourself, as you say, a blues man in a blues soaked America. What's Cornel West blues these days?
The power of love, the power of education, love itself, of other people, of wisdom, of justice, but also being open enough to be vulnerable enough to muster the courage to think critically, to re-examine and re-scrutinize, re-interrogate who we are, where we're going, similarly so for society, similarly so for the world. And when you bring together that power of love on the one hand, where it's fundamental commitment to the welfare of others, especially beginning with the least of these. And I go back again to prophetic Judaism, which is, of course, the very source of my own Christianity, the first chapter of Isaiah, the orphan, the widow, the fatherless, the oppressed, and then mediated through this love in which justice is what love looks like in public. So you're fighting for justice, motivated by compassion, raising Socratic questions. And blues, for me, is the lyrical expression of that power of love and that power of awakening that's associated with deep education. And so I am a blues man in the life of the mind and a jazz man in the world of ideas and blessed to be a part of a great tradition. And that can go from Louis Armstrong to Stephen Sondheim or Harold Arlen or Tennessee Williams in literary blues, B.B. King, Toni Morrison, Ralph Ellison, James Baldwin, or it could be an everyday person on the block who can't sing in pitch but whose life is shaped by the power of love and the power of democratic reawakening through their own forms of education.
And I'm listening to the people you say fall in this pantheon of blues. What is it that unites them? It has something to do with soul.
Yes. It has something to do with...
And it has a little something to do with pain.
After it begins, Ralph Ellison says, blues is an autobiographical chronicle of a personal catastrophe expressed lyrically. In Sondheim, you get the catastrophic, into the woods, flip over the fairy tale. You see, the catastrophic, in Kafka, you begin with the transformation into a huge, foul vermin. That's catastrophic for Gregor. Strange Fruit the Southern Trees Bear, Billie Holiday. Jewish Brother Maripol wrote the lyrics. Jim Crow, American Terrorism, that's catastrophic. And B.B. King says, nobody loves me but my mama, and she might be jiving too. That is catastrophic. What you gonna do? Compassion still flows. Sing your song.
Great.
Keep moving.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, my dear brother Terry. Always a blessing, man.
His website is cornelwest.com. The new book is Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud, a memoir. Cornel West, keep up the good work.
You keep up the good work, my brother.
Thank you.
I love you much, man.